from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from Wharton San Francisco's Executive MBA program, delivering a rigorous academic experience immersed in the unique Bay Area ecosystem and access to a globally connected network. wharton.upenn.edu. The California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, so many Californians are afraid of where the country's headed under President Trump. But we'll meet some farmers and ranchers who feel like they don't have to be so nervous anymore.
We had fears too. All those visceral fears you're watching with people, that would be me in the fetal position watching some of the things that happened under the Obama administration.
And a new play premiering in Los Angeles takes us into the future to show us a more sinister vision of a changed America just a few years into the Trump presidency.
American theater today has to decide, are we curating history or are we going to make history?
Plus, we learn about a decades-long friendship that began at a Central Valley grocery store. I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. We've just passed the halfway point of President Trump's first 100 days in office, and we thought it would be a good time to check in with some folks from rural California, farmers and ranchers. We wanted to ask them about Trump's proposed changes to things like immigration and longstanding environmental policies. To start us off, KQED science reporter Leslie McClurg takes us to Tehama County.
Like most ranchers I talk to, Wally Roney wouldn't live anywhere but at the dead end of a road.
Right here is where the pavement ends and the west begins.
Roney swings open a rusted cattle guard dripping from a recent rainstorm.
You're looking at Aberdeen Angus steer calves.
The cows swing their heads up from grazing on clover. The setting sun reflects off their black, shiny coats. Roney grazes cattle on private and federal land. He's the sixth generation of his family to ranch here. When I ask him how many cows he has...
That's something you don't ask a cattleman.
Oh, really?
We never have enough when it comes time to pay our bills, and we always have too many when it comes time to feed them.
We hop in a huge silver pickup for a tour of Roney's ranch. We bump along a potholed road beneath giant oak trees. He pulls over at a creek where his cattle often drink. Roney cheered last month when Trump shelved a law that would have expanded the Clean Water Act.
He said he was going to do it, and by golly, he did it.
Roney thought the law might limit where his thirsty cows could drink. He voted for Trump because the candidate is a businessman.
He hasn't made a living or tried to make a living being a politician. He's been in the trenches. You know, I understand that world.
Although Hillary Clinton won California in a landslide, 4 million people still voted for Trump. And here in Tehama County, it was Trump who won by a landslide.
He's our only hope.
Roney was relieved when Trump scrapped the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement in his first week in office. He worried that cheaper beef from Mexico would have driven down his profit margins.
TPP would have killed us.
Roney hopes Trump will build on these moves by rolling back environmental regulations, although he does believe in some rules, as long as they don't apply to him. For example, he supports the mining regulations on a gravel quarry on his property.
To protect that ground, we need to have certain regulations to keep them from destroying it.
He points out the window to the rim of mountains bordering his property.
On that skyline is probably some of the biggest pot gardens in California. Yeah, we need regulations. They hate me.
But he argues ranchers are different. They don't need environmental rules to keep them in check. Just down the road, another sixth-generation rancher named Daryl Wood agrees.
As ranchers, you know, we're stewards of these landscapes.
We jump in an ATV to check on his herd, and his dogs run alongside. His cows are certified organic.
It's called Panorama grass-fed beef.
No one in Wood's family has ever used chemicals on the rolling grasslands. He says he's motivated to farm organically because his beef sells for 25% more at market. But it also, it feels right.
Land is what gives life to everything. So you got to love the land. We love the cattle. We love the dogs, our horses.
Wood is a lifelong conservative who believes in market forces rather than rules to protect the landscape from things like overgrazing.
So my theory on this is that, okay, the more regulations you have on something is not good. So let's create the incentive that makes them change their management practices.
Wood hopes Trump's administration will listen to ideas from people like him to create more incentive-based policies rather than more regulations.
Not just a group of people in Washington, D.C., sitting around a table and deciding what's best for me on my land. I want to be at that table.
A lot of people I talk to in Tehama County feel similarly, that the environmental conversation hasn't included their voices. Billy Roney says it best. She's the wife of rancher Wally Roney.
Is there anybody anywhere who I feel like-minded with who might be a little less radical? I've just felt disenfranchised for a long, long time.
Roney says she empathizes with people who are scared right now by what they're hearing from Trump. She felt like that about Democratic plans to tighten gun control, expand immigration, and rewrite health care laws.
We had fears, too. All those visceral fears you're watching with people, that would be me in the fetal position watching some of the things that happened under the Obama administration.
Now, Billy Roney says listening to Trump is a welcome relief after 8 years where she felt like her way of life was not only ignored, but despised by the other side.
The Progressive Party looks at people like us as though we're the devil. It makes it really hard to find common ground.
Most everyone I talked to in Tehama County said the only way to bridge the divide in California and the nation is for everyone to be at the table. For the California Report, I'm Leslie McClurg.
And now we're going to head to another farm, about 500 miles south of that cattle ranch in Ventura County. In this part of rural California, President Trump's policies have both farmers and farm workers on edge. Valerie Hamilton has our story.
It doesn't get more idyllic than the rolling hills above the farm community of Santa Paula. Acres and acres of avocado and citrus trees, like a postcard from California's small farm past. This is a rural area, but people here aren't Trump voters. Santa Paula voted 2-1 against him. Part of the reason is standing right here, on top of a ladder, cutting avocados for harvest.
We don't have papers, though. You know, we cross the border, they say illegally.
Luis is originally from Mexico. We're not using his full name because of worries he could be deported. He's been working here for 4 years. He's one of about 36,000 immigrant workers, many of them undocumented, bringing in Ventura County's harvest. It's hard work. He's hauling 80-pound bags of avocados down the ladder and dumping them in collection bins over and over again.
That's a pretty nice workout, though.
It is a workout, but Luis says he likes his job, and he's good at it, which is why the farm, Brokaw Ranch Company, wants to keep him.
If we have a good crew, we don't want to lose it.
Jose Alcaraz is the ranch manager. He's a U.S. citizen now, but he came to Santa Paula from Mexico 36 years ago without papers, just like Luis. So he gets why ranch workers are worried about Trump. It's the same reason ranch businesses are worried, too.
We are in the same boat, so I think we need each other. We're concerned. If they're concerned, we are concerned too.
Farms were having trouble finding workers even before Trump's election. Field work is hard and the pay is not great, about $12 an hour to start. Ranch owner Ellen Brokaw says U.S. workers don't want the jobs, and so she depends on immigrants to keep the business going.
Some people apply, but almost never do any of them stay. So there's no way that we can take care of and pick our crops without immigrant labor.
Now, with Trump in the White House, farm communities like Santa Paula are worried he'll deport their workforce, who also happen to be their neighbors.
Under Obama, there was a lot of deportations, but they were definitely targeting people with a criminal record. And now, anybody who gets stopped or confronted who doesn't have papers is vulnerable. And, you know, it's an awful way to live under that shadow.
There have already been arrests reported nearby, and people here are scared, Alcaraz says.
They just hear the news and TV and the radios, and they attacking each other. A lot of things bad happen.
So they're preparing for the worst. Local community groups are doing outreach to make sure undocumented people know their rights. One group has set up text alerts for ICE raids. Luis says he's keeping his head down, staying on the right side of the law.
I'm trying to do good, you know, because I'm planning to live my whole life right here. I really like it. California is a pretty good state.
And with a wave, he heads off back to work. For the California Report, I'm Valerie Hamilton in Santa Paula.
So, time machine time. Hang on as we hurtle forward to the year 2019. President Trump may or may not still be the president. Those immigration policies we were just talking about, though, have been carried out to an extreme. And one man ends up paying a very high price. That's the backdrop of playwright Robert Schenken's Building the Wall, which has its world premiere this weekend in Hollywood. And as the California Report's LA Bureau Chief Stephen Cuevas explains, the play is also breaking down some walls in American theater.
We first meet Rick inside a federal lockup. He's a military veteran. He grew up in Texas, and now he's a prisoner.
I don't have anybody to talk to in here.
You're in solitary, yes?
For my own protection.
Rick used to work in a place just like this, a private prison on the Tex-Mex border, housing scores of immigrants rounded up under the Trump administration. He was the warden. And some pretty bad things happened on his watch.
There's nothing really extraordinary about him except the circumstances in which he eventually finds himself and the choices he sadly makes.
Robert Schenken, who grew up in Texas, is best known for his Pulitzer Prize-winning saga, The Kentucky Cycle, and for screenwriting credits that include films like Pump Up the Volume and Hacksaw Ridge, projects that typically have long gestation periods. Building the Wall was different.
I wrote this before the election in what I describe as kind of a white-hot fury in the space of a week.
Speaking in the upstairs cafe at the Fountain Theater in Hollywood, Schenken says he was spurred by the anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies of Donald Trump, but unlike previous works like The Kentucky Cycle that require huge ensemble casts, Building the Wall is theater minimalism. One room, two characters.
This is what this story needed. It only needed these two people. Out of that, we feel an entire world of individuals caught up by the events. But it's not necessary for us to see those events or to visit with those people.
But the worst part was me sitting there all those weeks listening to that being said and not able to respond.
So you want to clear the record. I get it. We can do that.
The drama, as heard in this rehearsal, revolves around Rick and a historian named Gloria, whom he's agreed to speak with about events that led to his conviction. We learn more about both as they sniff out each other's motives and beliefs. He's white, she's black. She didn't support Donald Trump, he did. He even describes attending his first Trump campaign rally.
Like being part of a wave or something, bigger than yourself. You didn't feel put down anymore. Shamed.
Gloria wants to know, but what about the violence?
Protesters getting beaten up?
Hey, those guys were there to provoke people and they succeeded. I mean, the whole thing was all kind of like pro wrestling thing, you know, a performance.
Some people got really hurt.
Nobody died.
No, that would come later.
Gloria is talking about the crimes that Rick committed, details of which we get as the drama unfolds. His attorney told him not to testify at trial. Now he wants to set the record straight. He chooses Gloria, the historian, as his confessor. The atrocities are of historic proportion.
I saw things. I know stuff that would make a lot of people look bad.
This is a fully rounded character, and before this play is over, we may still have some judgments, but we understand him in a very different way.
Michael Michetti jumped at the chance to work with a Robert Schenken script that's so timely. He's directing Building the Wall's L.A. run at the Fountain Theater.
And Robert gives a real voice to the people who we now know felt very underrepresented and therefore they supported Trump's candidacy and presidency.
The character of Rick has to answer a very important question. When is it time to say no?
Stephen Sachs is the Fountain's artistic director.
When is it time to stand up and say, no, I will not do this. I will not follow orders.
Yeah, one of the many. Okay.
Sachs says the cast, the staging, just like the script, was assembled fast in a matter of weeks.
Oh, it's extraordinary. This does not happen.
On the afternoon I visit, the set was still being painted, actors deep in rehearsal. Shenkin says it typically takes months, years, to go from the page to the stage.
It'll be too late by then. American theater today has to decide, are we curating history or are we going to make history? Are we going to be involved in what is happening right now?
Building the Wall premieres this weekend at the Fountain Theater in Hollywood, with theaters in cities across the U.S. staging simultaneous performances through the spring. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles.
And now we turn to some L.A. jazz and a pair of musicians with new albums out this month, Alex Klein and Cameron Graves. As the California Report's Susie Racho and our jazz critic Andrew Gilbert tell us, these artists draw inspiration from something other than politics.
So we're going to talk today about two albums that have a couple of things in common, the first being spirituality. And we're listening to a piece from Oceans of Vows from the Los Angeles drummer Alex Klein's Flower Garland Orchestra, and it's inspired by the Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, he's 90 years old now, an amazing figure, you know, peace activist going back 60, 70 years. And Alex Klein has long wanted to set some of his poetry and some sutras to music. And he created this epic work, two CDs, 2 hours of music, an amazing all-star ensemble. And it's really, really beautiful stuff.
And we should also mention he's the twin brother of guitarist Nels Klein, who most famously plays with Wilco, but also has a very illustrious solo career of his own. But there's also this kind of mirroring, not just with the twins, but in the band too, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting where you have two guitarists. So there's Nels is on this, G.E. Stinson's also on it, two violinists, percussionists. He doesn't overwork the point, but you kind of get this back and forth going on.
And like you mentioned, this is a really interesting project in a lot of ways. The fact that it's so long is one, so you get over 2 hours of music. But as a listening experience, would you say it's best taken as the entire suite, or are there songs on this that stand out to you individually?
Yeah, tracks definitely stand up on their own, but there is something about listening to a whole disc and just kind of getting swept along in it. Pieces develop slowly. It takes a little patience. Some of the tracks are 15, 16 minutes long. But it's really wonderful to hear sort of how players or the vocalist, Irini Agbabian, sort of emerges from the mix.
That's Oceans of Vows from Alex Klein's Flower Garland Orchestra. And spirituality is also a theme on the new album from pianist Cameron Graves. That's the end of Corporatism from Cameron Graves' Planetary Prince. Now, where's the spiritual inspiration for this record, Andy?
So he is drawing on this, it's called the Urantia Book, and it's this sort of mysterious, big, esoteric tome that appeared in Chicago in the 1920s or 30s. A lot of musicians have found inspiration in it, Stockhausen, Jimi Hendrix, but a lot of ways the inspiration you really hear is coming from his fellow musicians and the West Coast Get Down, sort of the same crew that recorded the epic with Kamasi Washington.
He's kind kind of coming out of this very fertile community that he's been a part of for a long time, kind of similar to the Alex Klein record.
Absolutely. You know, we kind of think of the Los Angeles scene as kind of atomized and hard to create a sense of community, but here you've got these two very specific groups of musicians who have played together for years. The West Coast Get Down, a lot of these guys have been playing together since high school. Alex Klein, well, obviously with his brother Nels, and Jeff Gautier, they've been playing together 40 years.
And so he's really part of this kind of fertile, genre-busting group of musicians, you know, the guys who backed Kendrick Lamar and also appeared, like you said, on the Kamasi Washington record. But how is he making his own statement?
Yeah, you know, if you look, though, there's a lot of overlap of personnel with the Epic. This is definitely not the Epic Part 2. It has this just pummeling energy, a lot of it. It draws on a lot of sort of the fusion, Chick Corea. McCoy Tyner wasn't making fusion in the 70s, but that energy, and particularly in the bass and drums, the Bruner brothers, Thundercat and Ronald Bruner, it is just high-energy, kinetic music.
And this is also another long statement. It's 80 minutes long, which is pretty long for a debut record, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It's generous, a generous amount of music. And it sustains its energy. It sustains. He has a lot of ideas. And you feel like sometimes he's trying to get them all in. But I really enjoyed the album. His compositions are interesting. The playing is pretty remarkable throughout.
Andrew has more on Cameron Graves' Planetary Prince and Alex Klein's Oceans of Vows at californiareport.org. Thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you, Susie.
Now we're going to bring you another in our StoryCorps series focused on Latinos in the San Joaquin Valley. This week we get to listen to a conversation partly in American Sign Language. It's between Armando Rivera, who is deaf, and his friend Paul Barnett. They met by chance in the early 80s at a grocery store. Armando taught Paul how to sign, and they've been friends ever since. An interpreter, who's a woman, translates Armando's side of the conversation. Armando makes vocal sounds when he signs. So you'll hear that too.
Well, let's see. I was in the grocery store and I was looking around and I noticed someone there and saying, "Excuse me." And then the, "Are you deaf?" "Oh no, you sign."
I knew the alphabet. And he was struggling with the clerk in the store. And
right.
So I, being a social work student, I thought I was going to save the world. So I jumped in to try and interpret and the little that I knew. And, you know, I thought it was a nice encounter. I wanted to learn a little bit more of the sign language. And so a week later, his mother calls and says, "Do you remember the deaf gentleman you met? They'd like to visit you." And I thought, well, sure, you know.
That's right. That's right. I forgot that part of the story.
And first three words that he taught me were yes, no, and tomorrow. And if you think about it, you know, those are probably the three most important words.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you've got a point there.
And about your mother and father, how did they communicate with you when you were growing up?
There was no signing. I was trying to lip read, but no signing.
Oh, okay. When you moved here to Fresno and you started work in the fields, what kind of work did you do? Grapes?
So we picked grapes, peaches. I mean, it was a variety of produce that we picked.
So describe a typical day, like when you were working in the fields, what time would you have to get up in the morning?
Oh, God, Oh, about three. It was 3 a.m.
How old were you when you started working in the fields?
It started when I was when I was 16 through my teen years.
Describe what it was like, you know, working in the vines. Was it, did you see spiders and was it dirty and dusty and...
Oh, God, there were spiders, there were bees, there were, you know, snakes, there was everything. And then you're looking at all of their droppings and so forth.
Yes.
Oh, at the end of the day, I was basically all black, filled with dirt. I mean, you could even feel the dirt in your nose, in your nostrils, because wow. When you're out there picking and you're breathing, you're inhaling all the dust and the dirt.
Uh-huh. Mondo, you told me a story once where your family was picking grapes and there was two rows.
My father and sister and brother were at one row and myself with my mom and other sibling were at the other row. So it was 3 against 3. And so what we do to alleviate the time is we'd create a race out of it, a competition, each of us to see who would finish the row, you know, which team would finish it. My father was happy when I was on his team because it meant, you know, his team won.
You know, I'm lucky that I met a native speaker who took the time and effort to teach me a different language, so I really appreciate that. Yeah, so we've been friends for 35 years now.
Hey, Papa!
This is pretty fun. This has been really fun.
That conversation between Paul Barnett and his friend Armando Rivera is part of a project with the Henry Madden Library at Fresno State. It was produced by the California Report with interviews recorded by StoryCorps, a national nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories in order to build connections between people and create a more just and compassionate world. The project was co-sponsored by Fresno State's Office of the President, the College of Arts and Humanities, the College of Social Sciences, and Valley Public Radio. And that's the California Report Magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Let us know what you think about our show. Send us a note at calreport@kqed.org or drop us a note on Facebook. Our director is Susie Rocho. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. And we had additional engineering from Katie McMurrin and Howard Gelman. Our online producer is David Marks. And our intern is Ryan Levy. We had production help from Eli Wertschafter and Lacey Jane Roberts. The California Report's senior editor is Victoria Maulione. Our editorial team includes Kat Snow, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report Magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring the recipients of the 2017 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. Learn more at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.